Well, good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. My name is Nigella Hillgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the latest in the Jeffrey B. Graham Lecture Series, Perspectives on Ocean Science. And it's my great pleasure this evening to welcome and introduce our speaker, Dr. Ron Burton. Ron was educated at University of Stanford, or maybe he calls it Stanford University, I can never get that right. He did his bachelor's, his master's, and his PhD at Stanford, and then in 1992, by way of University of Pennsylvania and University of Houston, he ended up at Scripps Institution of Oceanography as an associate professor in marine biology. And in 1995, he became a full professor in the Marine Biology Research Division. And since 2004, he has been head of the biology section here at Scripps. Now, tonight he's going to talk mainly on some of the more unusual and exciting sort of forensic work, the detective work that you can do using the techniques in genetics, really in marine biology. But I wanted to just give you a very short background about some of his own research. He works on genetics of small marine invertebrates, particularly intertidal copepods, Tigriopus, or Tigriopus. I've just had a long discussion about how to pronounce the scientific name. It has very strong genetic divergence among the populations up and down the coast of California. And he's also looked a lot at the genetic basis for why when two species of these copepods hybridize, you get lowered fitness when these two populations hybridize. He's also worked on sea urchins and on abalone. So without further ado, it's a great pleasure to introduce Ron Burton.
Is this on? Am I okay? Okay. Thanks, Nigella, and thank you all for coming. I understand there's some pretty strong competition out there in the football world, and also Justin Timberlake, I hear, is in town tonight. So I feel honored that you're here. What I want to do today is discuss some of my own work and some work of colleagues and other people in the field that demonstrate for you some of the great power that we've achieved in using DNA to study marine ecology. I mean, when I first came into the field, nobody was sequencing DNA. It was we were a little early. I've been in this field too long, I guess. But what has happened in the last decade or so has been truly amazing, and I'm doing work in my lab that I never could have envisioned doing just a decade ago. The focus of the work that I'll be talking about today has to do with DNA forensics, and let me proceed to tell you what I'm talking about there. First, what's DNA? I think most of you in the room have some vague idea of what DNA is. It is, of course, the genetic blueprint that organisms receive from their parents. Okay, we can all agree to that. It's a beautiful double helical structure, but in fact it's fairly monotonous because it's just a string of four different building blocks. And here are the different building blocks just in color code. And those building blocks just repeat along this double helix, okay? And the hereditary information that makes you different from a sponge or different from a monkey or your friend simply lies in the order of the building blocks, the A's, C's, T's, and G's as we abbreviate these. And you should just be aware that there's a lot of room for variation between you and your friend because you have 3 billion of these bases, of these building blocks in your genetic code. So the order of these 3 billion bases is what makes you what you are. They're your hereditary building blocks. Now, within stretches of DNA, we can define genes. And genes are stretches of DNA that encode a specific protein. And just to give you an example you might be familiar with, hemoglobin, that red pigment in your blood, is a protein, and it's encoded by a particular stretch of DNA. Okay? And if we had the sequence of A's, G's, C's, and T's that defined your hemoglobin, or that of a human, it might look something like this. I made this up, but I wasn't going to tell you that. A chimp would have a DNA sequence that's very similar to yours, but would show some differences, and so I've highlighted here one difference. A mouse would be somewhat more differentiated in its hemoglobin, and I've noted that by showing a few more differences, and a salmon, a fish, would be even more differentiated. Okay, but all of these organisms have hemoglobin, and they're all related, and you can assess the degree of similarity by looking at how many changes in the DNA have occurred, and you can show this in a tree-like form where humans and chimps are more similar to each other and shown closer as branches of a tree, a mouse is further off, and then the salmon being further off again. Okay, so we'll see these trees repeatedly, and I wanted you to know where they were coming from. Now, how does DNA forensics work? What are we talking about here? And I think had I done this a few years ago, I might have had more to talk about, but Horatio has explained this to most of us now, and if you really want to understand DNA forensics, you can just go to the CSI website and look up DNA test, and they'll give you some of the details. Okay? The basic idea, though, is that any type of organism, as I just described in the terms of the hemoglobin sequences, for example, each organism can be identified by examination of DNA sequences that are unique to that species. Now, some sequences are shared between species to a large degree. So between human and chimps, there are some stretches of genes that we can't distinguish between human and chimp because we are so closely related. But as you get to more distant organisms, we can identify each one. And so you can identify specific stretches of DNA that will distinguish species, one from the next, and distinguish individuals within a species, one from the next. So you are different from anybody other than your identical twin, and we can distinguish you by that sequence of A's, G's, C's, and T's along the 3 billion bases. Now, just to kind of get you into the flow of what I wanted to talk about tonight, I'll tell you about a little story that has to do with the Birch Aquarium. And that is, some years back, I got a phone call. The person on the other end says, hey, Ron, can you use some of that DNA mumbo-jumbo to clear up a species identification problem? I said, what are you working on? And he says, seahorses. And I said, well, geez, I don't know anything about seahorses, but... And while I'm talking to him, I'm thinking about, well, how would I go about doing species identification of seahorses? And is there information available that would let me do that without, you know, starting from scratch and doing a 10-year project, which I had no intention of doing, regardless of how much I liked the Birch Aquarium? So what I did, and what anybody can do now, is instantly at your fingertips on the internet, you can look up and see, has somebody studied DNA sequences in a particular species of interest? And so while I'm on the phone talking and stalling this guy at the other end, I'm checking to see if I can, in fact, do this project easily and make myself sound like I'm doing a lot of work for them. I go to this website. It's sponsored by National Institutes of Health, and it's commonly referred to as GenBank. And in GenBank, there's a thing called the Tax Browser, which is a taxonomy browser. This means you can enter the name of any species, the scientific name, and say, what sequences are known from this species? So I enter in... I am a marine biologist, after all. I enter in hippocampus. I do know the genus of seahorses. I took fish systematics many, many years ago. And instantly it comes back and says, oh yeah, all of these different species have been studied. There's DNA sequences available. I look further and it says DNA sequences from lots of different species have been determined for a specific gene. And that gene, not hemoglobin in this case, the gene is called cytochrome B. Okay? We don't need to know any more about that except that that's a gene that's been studied for lots of species. So if I want to determine the differences between species, if I want to identify an unknown sample handed to me by somebody at the Birch Aquarium, what I need to do is sequence cytochrome B. Can I do that? And the answer is, because all of those other people have done it already, I just look up and say, how did they do it? And then I go to the store, I order the reagents, and instantly I can be a hero. I can amplify the cytochrome B gene. What that means is, in order to sequence the DNA of a particular gene in a sample, we need to first make lots of copies of that particular gene. Lucky for me, a guy named Kerry Mullis, some of you might know, he was a La Jolla local, he's a local surfer, he got a Nobel Prize for figuring out how to do this. And I'm not going to go into detail here other than to say, all you do is you need to buy a couple of small pieces of DNA, which now cost $2.50 a sample. When I first started, it cost about $70 a sample. And in a machine that I happen to have seven of them, but every lab has one, it seems, you throw this stuff together and it amplifies this gene so that you can then go through and do the next procedure, which is sequencing. This won the Nobel Prize for Frederick Sanger. And you notice, you know, this the procedure for DNA sequencing that Sanger produced, I think, was discovered or invented in the late 70s. So he got the Nobel Prize shortly thereafter. And you can see why, when I was a young punk, we weren't all doing DNA sequencing. This is all within the last couple of decades. Now it's like that. We have a machine down the hall from me where I can put this together, and I can go from the sample of seahorse that's brought to me, and that sample can be the size of a pinhead, to amplifying the gene and then sequencing it. This can all be done in one day. Okay? And so we can get the DNA sequence. Now, when you get the sequence, all it is it's a series of what? A's, G's, C's, and T's. And you get the sequence from multiple different sources, and you can compare them and decide who matches with whom. DNA sequences come off of a machine now, and they look like little, these are chromatograms, and depending on the color of the little hump in the chromatogram determines whether it's an A, C, T, or G. Here I've shown three different sequences of a cytochrome B gene, and you notice two of them have A's at this location and one of them a G. And these are the sorts of differences that we're talking about. So using DNA as a species identification tool can be fairly straightforward. And the case study was a series of animals that had been raised at this institution thinking that they were a hippocampus cuda. They were thought to be hippocampus cuda from the Indo-Pacific because that's what the aquarium store owner that sold the sample to us said they were. They were hippocampus cuda. Okay, but some question arose as other people looked at these samples and said, you know, that doesn't look quite like hippocampus cuda. Are you sure? Well, it came to me. I did the work. From the GenBank database, here are the two sequences of two different seahorses, Hippocampus cuda and another species, Hippocampus erectus. And here's the unknown seahorse that I sequenced. And sure enough, it was a perfect match for Hippocampus erectus. Not quite as exotic as being Indo-Pacific, it's from Florida. Okay? But a very straightforward application of DNA technology. There's nothing tricky about this. There's hundreds of labs that can do this work. So I was a little bit surprised when shortly after doing this, this fact, you know, the identification was announced at some aquarium meeting, and I got a call shortly thereafter from a woman named Sarah Lurie, who had written a book on seahorse identification, and she sent me a copy of her book. It's a beautiful book, well illustrated and all that. And she asked if she could please come to my lab to learn how to identify seahorses. I said, you know, yeah, sure. And she came, and now she does this routinely. She does DNA sequencing to identify seahorses. In fact, she's written a dissertation, I believe, on Hippocampus cuda. Well, of course, I just sit around in my office waiting for phone calls, and I got another one. And the next phone call I got came from Professor Dave Checkley, a Scripps biological oceanographer. And Dave is well known for his work on looking at the distribution of fish eggs and larvae in order to determine spawning patterns and things in the open ocean. And Dave is... invented a system so that while a ship is actually cruising through on its way to wherever it wants to go, it can be sampling continuously for fish eggs. So he's invented the underway fish egg sampler. Well, in the process of this, he gets a lot of fish eggs, and some of them he can look at and tell what they are, okay, because he's seen so many of them and he knows what they hatch into. But a lot of the eggs he can't identify. A fish egg, to some extent, is a fish egg. And given that there's 800 different species of marine fish out there in California waters, it's a little bit difficult to always know what you got. So he said, hey, what about that mumbo-jumbo thing? Can you do the DNA trick and tell me what these fish eggs are? And I said, well, that shouldn't be much of a problem. So I got the samples. I did the DNA sequencing. I used the cytochrome B gene as before. But when I went to the database to look for the match and find out what it is, there was no match. There was nothing that came particularly close other than some other fish that it said, gee, they're about 15% different. That's a lot of difference. And so it's kind of like, you know, being at the crime scene, getting the fingerprint, running it through the FBI database and finding no match. The fingerprint doesn't do you much good until you find a suspect. So we had this problem, and I was quite surprised. And so I started investigating in GenBank. I went in and started looking, you know, here are a few fish that it might be. Are they represented in the database? And the answer, surprisingly, was no. Even though there's thousands of fish DNA sequences in GenBank, they were all put in there because people were studying specific problems dealing with specific species or groups of species. And in a lot of cases, they were studying different pieces of DNA. You know, one they had studied hemoglobin in, one they had studied cytochrome B in. And so if I just had cytochrome B sequence and the only sequence in the database was hemoglobin, I wouldn't get a match. So what we need is a database where the same gene is sequenced for all of the potential species of interest. When I started looking to see if the database was very good in that way, we found that it was awful. Even the anchovy, you know, that's a pretty abundant fish out here, wasn't in the database at the time, and this was only a few years back. So in sum, the database wasn't up to the task. And the task, by the way, is one that's common throughout biology. Matching the larval forms of many different types of species is quite difficult. You look at a caterpillar and it's hard to tell what kind of butterfly or moth it's going to become, right? And so this is a common theme for biologists, is trying to identify eggs and larvae and match them with appropriate adults. In marine systems, it's particularly problematic as we have very weird larval forms that float around. This is a larval sea urchin. Okay, if you, and by the way, the sizes aren't quite on par. This thing is microscopic. Thank God, that'd be a pretty scary beast. And this is, you know, a good-sized sea urchin. Spiny lobsters. That's what an adult spiny lobster looks like. This is something that's floating around in the ocean that turns into a spiny lobster. So that's what the larvae look like. So this is a common problem. And when you start to think about the uses of DNA, what's great about it is, you know, from egg to adult, your DNA doesn't change, okay? So I can take a tissue from an egg, from a larva, an adult, and I should get the same DNA sequence. So we can match larvae with adults if we can get these DNA sequences. So why not develop our own database of DNA sequences? After all, there's only 800 species. And all we really need is a short piece of DNA. And these short pieces of DNA have been termed now DNA barcodes. Just like in the grocery store, you have a barcode where you can identify any product, a universal barcode. Because the DNA of each species is somewhat different, a short piece of DNA from each species can be an identifier for that species. But we need a database that sequences the same gene for all of the different possible species. Okay? So this barcoding is now becoming a standardized approach, whether it's for caterpillars to butterflies or sea urchins or fish. Okay? And the genes that are getting used a lot, and this is a technicality, are mitochondrial genes. Each of you, in addition to the large genome you inherit from your mother and father, you also get an extra little bit from your mother only. And that's the mitochondrial genome that encodes a very small number of genes. But those genes evolve very rapidly, which means they tend to be distinct between species, making them particularly attractive for using in this barcoding approach. And just an aside, just to show you, here's a bunch of sequences for the gene of interest, cytochrome oxidase in this case, a mitochondrial gene, where these are a bunch of human sequences, and notice in the tree, they're all basically on the same branch of the tree. The chimpanzee is slightly different, a bonobo is different from the chimpanzee, the gorilla is different from them. So in other words, using just a short stretch of DNA, in this case 640 bases, that's how much you can get in doing one sequencing reaction, we can tell apart all these species, and we don't have to sequence the 3 billion DNA base pairs that are the entire genome of the species. So in humans, we might only have one or two differences out of the 648 that were sampled, where the humans differ from chimpanzees at 60 locations, gorillas at 70. Okay, we can apply the same thing to our fish study. And so with the support of California Sea Grant, put that out of the way, we were able to get the funding to go through and begin this study. We've now done over 500 species where we've done the DNA sequencing. We have them in the database. And so now other people, when they want to identify whether it's a fillet at a fish market, a larva or an egg taken from the field, they can sequence this one gene, compare it to our database, and identify the species. Okay, so difficulties with morphological identification of fish larvae, baby fish, a lot of them look a lot alike. They're hard to tell apart. Once we have the complete database, we can work on ways to even speed things up more so we don't even have to sequence as much to get the information about the identity. But right now, we could take a larva like this, sequence it, and match it to our database. And just to show you, we're not the only ones doing this. There's a worldwide effort to barcode fish, barcode Lepidoptera. Those are the moths and butterflies. And in Canada, they're particularly enlightened. They intend to do this barcoding effort on every eukaryotic organism, plant and animal. And they've started that with a multi-million dollar grant, a little bit more than I had to do the fish. Now, in addition to identification of larvae, we can use these sort of methods to track movements of larvae in adults. And the basic idea is that if there's variation within a species, if organisms move between populations, when they move, they take their genes with them, And so they would tend to homogenize the different populations, and you wouldn't get differences. But if organisms aren't moving back and forth, gradually there'll be the evolution of genetic differentiation between the populations. Let me show you how we can make use of this fact to address some important ecological issues. In the early 70s, a guy named Rudy Scheltema of Woods Hole, that's the enemy, by the way, I'm at Scripps. So what do we want to do? We want to show the enemy's wrong, right? Well, what the enemy had done was Scheltema had done an amazing number of plankton tows across the ocean. So we recognize this as North America, here's Europe and Africa. And these are all tows, plankton tows, where he had found the larvae of coastal invertebrates. Okay, and what he inferred from this is, remember those larvae, like the larvae of the lobster I showed you, or the sea urchin, is that those larvae are out in the water long enough that they get carried by currents and routinely can cross the Atlantic. Okay, and that was his hypothesis, that if they live long enough, they can cross the Atlantic. I was skeptical, but fortunately, I wasn't the only one, and somebody did the work. This is a work on little snails, which is one of the species that Scheltema had found the larvae all the way across the ocean. And the answer is, okay, remember, if the populations are similar, then there may well be dispersal. If the populations are different, there's probably not dispersal. Without going into much detail, let's say for each gene that was tested, the types that were present in a French population were completely different from New England population. So, of course, the enemy was wrong. This is our goal in life. And we clearly can demonstrate that even though the larvae are found all across the ocean, they are not traversing the ocean. If they get across, they are unsuccessful in reproducing because those populations on either side are completely distinct. This is a question we really couldn't answer until we had these sorts of genetic data. Now, closer to home, telling you a little about my own work, we have populations of organisms that are restricted to rocky habitats. All of you have been out to tide pools probably and seen that there's organisms that live in rocky habitats that don't live on the sandy beaches that separate them. And so there's an important question in marine ecology is, to what extent are the populations of organisms that we see here distinct from populations on neighboring rocks? Okay. Most of these organisms have larval stages that drift. A lot of them could be, you know, carried by the currents. Even as adults, they could be moving back and forth. We really don't have a good picture as to what the structure is of these populations. Should we think of all of the sea urchins on all of these rocks as being one population? Or would this population be different from this one? Well, to address this question, I've focused on this copepod, which I call Tigriopus, but there are alternative pronunciations, as we've heard. This is an adult female. This is a larval stage. Again, you can see you wouldn't necessarily know they were even the same species. But the question is, they live in these high tide pools, and I asked my marine invertebrate professor when I took marine invertebrate biology. I took it when I was very, very young. That's why this date is here. Don Abbott, one of the great marine invertebrate biologists of all times for the California coast, I asked him, are those populations isolated on different rocks or not? He looked at me and said, well, obviously, Tigriopus is a weedy species. It needs to colonize those high pools. They dry up in the summer. They get blown out in the winter by storms. There's going to be a lot of mixing. You won't find any differences among the populations. Mark Feldman, who became my graduate advisor, taught me population genetics, got me interested in using a genetic approach to address this question. Now, you need really sophisticated gear to go out there and study this organism. Here's one of my former graduate students. He has now mastered the technique of taking a fishnet and collecting these things. And here's what we found out. And I found this out when I was a graduate student. Again, I was 8 years old, 1979. Okay. We sampled two places that were very close together, 500 meters apart on the shore. And what these are is little pie diagrams of the different genetic types that we encountered. So the yellow type was found in both places, although in different frequencies. But notice the blue type, it's just for a particular gene, an enzyme gene. The blue type was found at 50% at this site and didn't even occur over here. Okay? Now remember, when organisms move, they take their genes with them, and so if these guys are moving, we should see the blue gene popping up here. This suggests that there's no movement between these populations 500 meters apart on the coast. Now, John Flowers, the graduate student who I showed in that previous slide, collecting Tigriopus, of course, his goal is to prove that his advisor is wrong. Okay. And so he went back and sampled the same places and found, much to his dismay, that they were still different. The blue gene still only occurred here, didn't occur there. Showing that over the course of now, we've sampled almost 30 years at this place, that there's been no extensive gene flow between these two places, no movement of the organisms. Well, you go back and you tell Don Abbott, you say, gee, Don, my results seem to show that there's a lot of differentiation. And Don didn't bat an eye. He said, well, of course the populations are different. The animals live their whole lives in those isolated little pools. And so why would you expect them to be mixing? So next time, get it in writing, right? So it wasn't in writing. We've gone on and sampled these using DNA methods, and we've found truly remarkable levels of differentiation of populations along the California coast. Again, it's a result that tells us a lot about the ecology of the organism that there would be just no way we could have determined without using these molecular methods. As I told you, the greatest student of marine invertebrates on the coast clearly had the story wrong because he didn't have access to those methods. Now, what else can we do with these methods now that we have them in hand? And I think you kind of get the picture as to how we can use them. One thing is, there's a tremendous number of invasive species coming into our waters and around the world. Okay? In this case, we're talking about the Chinese mitten crab, not surprisingly, comes from China. And it's invaded around the world, including in San Francisco Bay, but all throughout Europe. And it's not somebody we're happy to see. It's a cute little crab indeed, but what it likes to do is burrow into dikes. You can imagine that's not popular up in Scandinavia or in the Sacramento Delta. Okay? And it weakens the dikes and levees. And the other thing that's been found out is it's a host to the oriental lung fluke, a human parasite, something we also would rather not see around our waters. Well, one of the questions that we have is, how did it get here? Okay? By what pathway? Is it being introduced from China, you know, through some kind of, you know, cargo liners or something? How is it getting here? Because that might influence how we try to control it. Is it constantly being brought in from various places? Did it all come from the same place? Well, right now, this is sort of early in the study of this particular problem in California. But what's interesting is, again, these are pie diagrams showing a particular genetic type. All of the animals collected in San Francisco Bay have been of this black type. When three places that were thought to be source locations in China were studied, that black type didn't even occur. In Europe, where it's been introduced, we are finding the black type. And so what this leads us to believe is two things. First is we're not getting a constant inundation from China, okay, coming over here. Because in China, they're variable. There's multiple types. And we don't see any of those types in our local populations. Some There's some possibility that it's not from the original source locality, but rather from these introduced sites, which have been here long enough to have evolved some of their own genotypes. Of course, these genotypes might also occur here in low frequency, and we just didn't see them in these initial samples. But it gives us the story that, first, it doesn't look like there's been lots of multiple introductions of this species, because we would expect to see multiple different genetic types, because all of the other locations have these different types. It seems like they may have been just introduced once, and it happened to be a small number of this particular genetic type that's occurring here now. Anyway, it gives us some clue as to what the origin of the invasion was. Similar work's being carried out now on Caulerpa. Some of you are familiar with the fact that there's an invasive weed that's been introduced in Carlsbad and other local estuaries that we very much want to control. And this sort of tracking is helping us understand where that invasion's coming from. Okay. Now, one of the more dramatic uses of DNA forensics in marine science came from a study of a couple of colleagues, Baker and Palumbi. Steve Palumbi, now at Hopkins Marine Station, was responsible for initiating this study. What was done is this. Whaling, as you know, has now been banned by and large. There are certain scientific whaling goes on still. But certain species have been protected for a long time. Humpback whale, for example, has been protected for a large number of years. There's no scientific permits to collect humpback whale. Well, what these guys did is they went to a Japanese market where there are whale products for sale. Okay. Now, there is scientific whaling that goes on, and those products are allowed to be sold locally. They're not supposed to be exported and so on. And what they did was say, gee, are those products for sale from the permitted species of whales? Okay? How can we test this? Well, in fact, it's illegal to move whale products around, so they couldn't even buy the meat and take it back to the lab. Instead, they packed up the lab in a suitcase and went there and tested samples of whale meat and got DNA sequences, to make a long story short. Okay? And you can't read these names, I know, but their samples are on here along with known identified samples that have been barcoded, basically. And so some of the samples they can definitively show are particular species. Many of them were from the permitted species, as expected, but a number of them definitely were not. And in particular, there's a sample of humpback whale that's there. And if you read their paper, it's pretty interesting. They say, this review of recent whaling activity indicates that products currently on the market were imported or processed illegally. The only other explanation is that the humpback whale meat had been in storage for 27 years and just happened to be for sale on the day they went and did their sampling. Pretty unlikely. Here's another interesting story, and that is what you buy at the market and what it's labeled as. Well, let's look at the story. This is the Gulf red snapper. It's a large fish. Red snapper in different parts of the country is different things, okay? But on the East Coast, this is red snapper. This is the only species that's allowed to be labeled for sale as red snapper in Gulf Coast states, okay? It's a popular food fish. You can see it's a big fish. It's a popular sport fish as well. So there it is, and its size is, you know, up to 30 pounds. Its record in Florida was 46 pounds. It's a big fish. Well, some friends of mine, Peter Marco, now at Clemson University, went and sampled at fish markets throughout the East and did the DNA sequencing just like we've been talking about. If everything was what it was supposed to be, this is where red snapper comes out in this tree showing relationships at one particular gene, the cytochrome B gene, like we used for seahorses. And what he found was, gee, here's one sample that he got, here's a sample, here's a sample. Now, What fish are these that are being sold as red snapper? Well, some of them look a lot like red snapper. The lane snapper lives in Florida. Really, the biggest difference is it's a much smaller fish, usually less than a pound, and the record, instead of 40 pounds, is 6 pounds. It's a small fish, but maybe a small individual might be confused as being the right thing. So let's give them the benefit of the doubt. It was an error. But look at some of these other fish. That doesn't look like that to me. And in fact, the record size of this thing is less than a pound. In fact, the average weight of these things is 250 grams, okay? So it's a small little fish, and most interestingly, it's from the Indo-Pacific, okay? So this thing being sold as Florida red snapper in the market is a tiny little fish imported from the Indo-Pacific. And in fact, the study found that over 50% of the samples were of species that don't even occur in U.S. waters, okay? So a bunch of imported things are being sold as red snapper. Now, the fish might taste just like a red snapper. It might be perfectly fine to do that. It's just not legal to label it what it's not. Okay, just a couple more examples and we'll finish this up. This was one of my favorites. The intraspecific variation, that is, within a species, there's enough variation that sometimes we can figure out what population the organism comes from, as we did in the copepods. Well, here's a study published in the Royal Society of London that shows that in one case, somebody in a fishing contest, okay, said, I caught this fish here, it's the biggest one, and he had originally won the contest. Some people were pretty skeptical that a fish that big, a 5.5 kilogram salmon, came from the waters involved in the contest. They did some genetic studies and basically showed it could not have come from that population. Ultimately, the offender confessed to purchasing the salmon at a local fish shop, and criminal charges were laid, okay? So this is true forensics. We got the guy. And now I think in my final example, yet another phone call, okay? I should stay away from my phone. In this case, it was a friend of mine who works up at Southwest Fisheries Science Center, just up the hill from Scripps, John Butler. And John said he had some interesting experience where he was down in Ensenada and saw some bags in a market labeled abalone for sale. Okay? Cost 200 pesos per kilogram, and I did the math for you. That's about 850 a pound. Okay? 850 a pound is a good price. If you can get abalone for 850 a pound, buy it. Okay? Buy it and sell it to a restaurant. They'll be very happy. They asked the seller, because they were skeptical, and the seller said they were pink abalone from southern Baja. John thought this sounded fishy, excuse that, and purchased a bag for us to test. Now, Kristen Gruenthal is a grad student in my lab, and what she studied? Abalone genetics. It's a good little thing for her to play around with. She went ahead, this all happened over Christmas break. The good news is, it is indeed some kind of snail. The bad news is, it's definitely not an abalone, okay? So these are abalone, and why can't I tell you what it is? Because it doesn't match anything in the database. So we need to build a database. Now, with mollusk, we're probably dealing with 25,000 species. It's going to take me a few more weeks before I can tell you what the deal is there. Just so you know that that is a good price, if you go online to the abalone farm, you can get abalone for $105 a pound, but, you know, let's be fair, that does include shipping. Yeah, I can mention this last example. Again, I thought the last one was my last example, but I can go on and on. This is an interesting case, just to understand marine ecology and potential of fisheries harvesting. If we look at a species like pink salmon have a strict 2-year life cycle. Now, most of you know salmon spawn in streams, and they swim out to the ocean, then they come back and spawn again. Now, if you have a two-year life cycle, that means that in a given stream, you can have two different populations, the ones that breed in the even number years and the ones that breed in the odd number years. I'm not sure they all know that they're even number fish or odd number fish, but they do have this two-year life cycle. And again, using genetic analysis, has been shown that they are hugely different. In some of the streams, the even year versus the odd year are quite different. In fact, hybrids have some trouble. It's not good to hybridize them. And so that has two implications. The first is, if you're going to have hatcheries trying to raise these things, you want to keep separate the even year animals from the odd year animals in order to prevent hybridizing and causing genetic problems of hybridizing between differentiated populations. And the second is, it suggests that if you're harvesting, you can, in fact, decimate by over-harvesting the even number year fish, and you may in fact have almost no effect, no impact at all on the odd number year fish. And so this might lead you to believe, if you didn't know there were these differences and you were just harvesting the fish out in the ocean, you might think, oh yeah, there's always fish out there, there's always fish, when in fact you may have totally decimated one of the populations. So again, this is the sort of impact that genetic studies have had on fisheries for a long time. Fisheries biologists have been using genetics to identify different populations of fish. Now, none of the work I do is done alone, and just to give some credit to my current lab crew, and here's Kristen. I talked about some of her work, and Chris are my graduate students, a host of talented undergraduates. And I'm happy to answer questions. Thanks. Yes, question. The question is, can I, you know, address how the things I've said bear on the question of evolution? And the answer is pretty clear, going back to, you know, my first slides, where I showed that if you look at a particular gene, like hemoglobin, okay, the level of DNA sequence divergence between the species closely resembles what we would relate as a phylogenetic tree. And so, you know, the reason why humans and chimps are more similar to each other in the hemoglobin gene, in the DNA, is because they had a more recent common ancestor. Okay, and if you go back further, the common ancestor between the human and chimp and the mouse is further back in time. And so DNA evidence is clearly one of the strongest types of evidence that we have for evolution of life on Earth, because we can piece this. Why does it take place is actually something that I study, and I haven't had an opportunity to talk about here. But it takes place due to a variety of processes, but they're actually fairly limited. You either have natural selection favor different genotypes in different places and gradually cause genetic divergence between two populations that, once they come back together, can no longer interbreed. Therefore, they're two different species. But there's another process, and that's random genetic drift. And that means that even if you just separate two populations, and even without the action of natural selection, random mutations occur in each of these populations. Random mutations are due to mistakes when DNA is replicated, when you pass your genes to your offspring and so on. So mistakes are made. You know, we're not perfect. Our enzymes that copy the DNA are not perfect. So random errors take place and gradually can accumulate between populations if they're isolated. Now, if they're not isolated, you don't expect new species to diverge. If gene flow continues to homogenize populations, then there's no genetic difference, and when you put them together, they'll interbreed, and they're still the same species. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Good question, and the answer is, I don't know, because he lost interest as soon as I told him we couldn't match it, so we kind of put it aside. And I think once we have our database, we'll go out and we'll do the matching again. We have matched other species, so we have been able to match other samples that we've gotten, in particular some white sea bass that have been handed to us and you know, can you match this? And yes, we can match them. When I say there's 800 species, that includes a lot of transient species that are fairly rare, deep water species and so on. We have a lot of the common ones, but not all of them. And so Sea Grant is still funding us to continue until we get an even larger database than we have now. So the answer is I'm not sure I've ever checked. He never came back and asked again. Yes?
If you're doing this study and you have to identify various species, you do it in the classical way by looking in the book and matching characteristics with the color and fin shape and all those sorts of things.
Yes, and that's a critical part of this whole barcoding effort. The data in the database are only as good as the taxonomy that went into identifying the original samples. And so this can't be done, you know, I can say I can identify any fish from its DNA, but that's only because somebody identified the fish for me that I took the DNA from. And so the way that we're doing this and the way barcoding the whole approach is being done is with the museums and our fish collection. That's why our project is a collaboration with me and Phil Hastings. Phil Hastings is the curator of fish, of marine vertebrates at Scripps. We have a large fish collection. Taxonomic experts have identified those samples, and those are the samples we use. So when we say, here is the sequence of an anchovy, we not only have had an expert identify the anchovy, we have the voucher specimen. So if anybody doubts us and says, I don't think that's the sequence from anchovy, I can say, this is the sample that I got my DNA from, and we can hand them the fish. Okay? So it's very important, like you said, to have taxonomic experts that can identify these things in the first place. Otherwise, you can't do this whole approach. So yes, the original specimens are all identified by experts in the respective fields. I'm not the one that identified the seahorses and so on. Yeah, Kirk.
Ron, Craig Fenner did the human genome, that's not running around human genome in the ocean. Moving to La Jolla.
Well, Craig Venter's doing the genome of the ocean as far as he's concerned, which nothing is larger than about 2 microns. Okay, so he's working on the microbes of the ocean. Of course, the advantage to my research is he has behind him a huge sequencing endeavor, and so I might not have to do my own sequencing. I might be able to take the samples in large bulk, thousands of samples, and send them to him rather than doing it myself. But his work is focused quite a bit on the microbes and not so much on this barcoding effort. There was another question? The question is a good one. The question is, the larvae that are drifting across the ocean, why are they not successful on the other side? Is that the basic question? Same thing for the California, the short distance thing. And the answer from my perspective is, if you find a larva in the middle of the ocean, it's likely to be lost for good. Okay? In order to be successful, these are shallow water marine invertebrates. They have to find a shallow water site. Most of the ones that are washed out in the middle of the ocean are never going to find appropriate habitat to settle. So the fact that you can find them out in the middle of the ocean doesn't mean much. The fact that he then found them on the other side, well, he doesn't know which genotypes he was finding. He was finding the French ones on the French side, the New England ones on the New England side, and in between a mix of hopelessly lost larvae. Okay? That's the interpretation, is that the larvae that get swept out into the open ocean are likely to be unsuccessful and just can't get there. And when, if they do, they're genetically differentiated, as we've now seen, from the animals on the other side, and there's a certain chance that they cannot interbreed. And so in the case of these snails, I don't think anybody's gone into the lab to try and show whether they are in fact even different species. They look alike. Larvae of a similar form were found throughout the ocean. The conclusion was it's the same species and there's transport. The genetic data show that's not the case.
Thank you very much, Ron. Okay. Wonderful job.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.